a guy I'd known since the day he got sober, and a good friend of mine. And without further ado, Gary, you have the floor. Turn this off so there isn't.
Thank you very much. My name is Gary Fiamengo, and I'm an alcoholic. I wanted to thank Owen for including me tonight. I have no experience with Al-Anon directly, even though I've been married for 30 long years. That's my wife speaking, not you know. But I hope that I am able to share my experience without saying anything stupid or offending anybody because of my naivete or lack of experience with the Al-Anon program. I want to, you know, thank Owen for this. As I said, I've known him. We share the same sponsor. I got my last drink. Was in August 16th, 2009. I don't use that as my sobriety date because I continued to use marijuana until December of that year, and hadn't been really working with the sponsor until I connected with my current sponsor, who has been my sponsor ever since. And that's how I came to know Owen. And we've been in friends and in contact ever since. If I manage to behave myself and by the grace of God, because I have no, you know, plausible explanation for how I've been able to, or how I've managed to stay sober and without a drink or a drug since that time, I will, you know, celebrate 13 years and this coming December, but I'm not taking any bets on that. I didn't get sober until I was 60 years of age. I started out much like anybody else as a teenager, high school kid, and did so from the standpoint of, you know, being accepted into the group of kids and the type of people that I was drawn to. It was, I never had any trouble making friends, or I did pretty well in school, but I never really applied myself. And you might, you know, I kind of fit that profile of the classic underachiever. So along those same lines, I didn't get married, until I was 40. Years of age. So I spent many years throughout my, you know, teenage years, 20s and 30s, basically wandering in the desert. And I have to be perfectly honest by saying that maybe there was certain ulterior motives in my, for me, you know, buckling down, because maybe I was afraid of that biological clock. I hated my 30s. I was very depressed. I was aimless. I was bouncing around despite my upbringing and education through in graduation from college, you know, just aimlessly going from, I use the term puddle jumping, from sales job to sales job, just, you know, lateral moves like that. And I actually met my wife tending bar. When I was tending bar, she wouldn't give me her phone number. She likes to say, she goes, if I'd have known then what I know now, I'd have headed straight for the hills. And she means it. And sometimes that's not so funny. But so I think there was a certain, you know, maybe that decision was somewhat, you know, to settle down and get married was, you know, there was a part of desperation to it, maybe. Maybe there was a certain disingenuousness to it in the sense that, well, I'm going to rely on somebody else, which is also a big part of my story about relying on others to get me out of a jam that I had created for myself. I was famous for walking up to any, you know, my, you know, whether it's my family members, you know, my employer, friends of mine with my hat in my hand. Not that I expected them to bail me out, but I was, you know, keeping my fingers crossed behind my back that somebody could help me out. Because part of me, you know, I was the type of guy that couldn't fight my way out of a paper bag. So there wasn't a whole lot of, planning toward my future. When I met my wife, I didn't have one red cent in the bank, despite the fact that I'd had some type of paying job, whether it was delivering newspapers or cutting lawns as a kid, all the way through high school and college, part-time, weekend jobs, summertime jobs. I didn't have one red cent, but I had $1,000 worth of unpaid parking tickets that I had stashed into the corner of a bedroom closet. I was sleeping on two mattresses, you know, that were just stacked on top of one another, you know, basically, what's the word? You know, I was taking advantage of the fact that, you know, my grandmother had passed away and I was living there under the guise of, you know, fixing up her house. And, you know, again, another ulterior motive when the house was sold in my mother's name, you know, I would be the benefactor of some of the proceeds from that sale. My wife also says now, even regarding those, the two mattresses stacked upon one another, she goes, that should have been my first clue. And she's right. I'm probably going to quote or spout off some of her euphemisms throughout the time I'm up here. She's had it up on the refrigerator for years. She goes, never question your wife's judgment. Just look who she married. Yeah. So, but certainly, my alcoholism and my continual drinking, without a doubt, affected the my immediate family. I have a 31-year-old son, a 28-year-old daughter. Throughout those times, there was certainly a lot of isolation. I would make sure that I bring up the fact about the marijuana only, not to digress from the alcoholism, because I did both. Although I started drinking at the age of 15, 16. I didn't start using marijuana until my early 20s. Actually, I was out of school, you know, and I'm a product of the 60s, you know, through San Francisco State, Berkeley, the counterculture, blah, blah, blah. I wasn't using weed. I wasn't smoking any pot until I got out of college, and I never took any psychedelics. I bring it up because, you know, 20 years into the marriage, the fact that, you know, my wife discovered at 7 o'clock on a Saturday morning that I was smoking pot in preparation for this milestone event party for 125 of my, you know, closest family and friends and neighbors. I couldn't find a way to not to help her out with the party without smoking weed at 7 o'clock. And when she discovered that, it didn't get any better for the rest of the day. And the reason I bring up that story is because by the end of the day, I was falling down drunk twice, once inside the house and once outside in the backyard. And she had pleaded with me. She had pleaded with me not to make it all about myself and not to have to, you know, resort to being the class clown and anything I would say or do just for the comic relief of bringing that negative attention to myself. And I couldn't figure out how not to do that. I had run it through my mind for weeks about how am I going to excuse myself from the party to go out and smoke some weed. And it never got to that point because I had already done that in the morning and gotten busted and then, you know, lived with this cloud of shame and guilt all day until I got to the party, until the party started and I just got stinking drunk. But 3 days later, the next day was my last drink. And 3 days later, or 2 days on Tuesday, whatever that was, I think it's the 17th of August, I went to my first AA meeting. And I had been seeing a counselor, a behavioral family counselor guy, therapist guy, for a number of years. I'd go by myself one-on-one. I'd go with Colleen, the two of us, with my son, the two of us, and with the whole family. And I'm not a technocrat. I've got between my hearing aids, which I have on, and my phone, which I have turned off. Now you've given me this to deal with. Thanks. I don't have enough problems. I don't have enough to deal with, for crying out loud. But I told him, I said, I think, and I was in the hottest water I'd ever been in my life because I knew the jig was up. I was either, you know, she was either going to leave me or kick me out or any combination of both. And so when I left him for the last time, I actually met with him over 13 years ago. I said, I think I'm going to go to an AA meeting. And people talk about what are those turning points or what are the things that you've heard or seen or experienced. He goes, well, it couldn't hurt. And I don't know why that made some sense or why that stuck with me. So that night I went to my first AA meeting. Now I never stopped going to meetings and I never picked up another drink, but I was smoking weed. And when one day we were driving at her, she goes, are you still smoking pot? I go, yeah, sometimes. She goes, I don't get it. And, you know, I didn't get not smoking pot. It took me discovering that my son had been raiding my stash in the woodshed. I was in there one day, and his book bag or his backpack or some of his school stuff was there. And he had left it in, and he had figured out where I kept the weed. And I go, well, he's not coming in here to cut the lawn, get the lawnmower to cut the lawn. He'd never done that once in his life. And he's, you know, so that, you know, that in its own odd way, you know, was the catalyst that kind of threw that hypocrisy, you know, slapped me right in the face with it. I'm happy for that. My sponsor has been very compassionate and understanding and deliberate with me. It took me close to a year to complete the steps. And one of the reasons for that was the continuing drama that was always erupting in some shape or form. My wife, and I don't know if this is appropriate for me to keep referencing here, because I certainly don't intend this to be, you know, a forum where, you know, for it to be construed that, oh, my wife would be an ideal candidate for Al-Anon. maybe she would, maybe she wouldn't. I just don't know that I've ever, I would dare broach the subject, because she holds a particularly dim view of alcoholism and what it has done, or what she considers that it has done to our family. I've made amends. Certainly they were the first, you know, they're at the top of the list, herself and my kids. And I, what I'm trying to do is, what I'm trying to do is to, sometimes we talk about practice the principles in all of our affairs, and sometimes the people that are the closest to you, and should mean the most to you, are the ones that, you know, suffer the worst consequences from my own bad behavior, from my own inability to get out of my own way, or to, you know, not put my self-interest or my self-absorbed perspective on things, because my anxiety, my angst, is palpable. We were going to the movies the other day to see Elvis. Have you ever seen Elvis? Well, you got to see it. You got to see it. But we're going to go to the matinee. And, you know, across town in Walnut Creek. And it's time to go. And I know for a fact that when it's time to go, and when I need to be someplace, she's going to go into slowdown mode. She's going to move as slow as she possibly can. And she's going to drive. And we get there, we park the car. It's 10 minutes to one for a 1:10 show. And I'm like this. We get to the movies. We pay the senior rate. It was great. It was $17 for two matinee seats, right? There was one person in the show. We had our pick of the, we could have sat anywhere we wanted. One man was sitting there in the middle. So we got our seats. And later that day or the next day, she goes, I could just sense it. I could feel it when we were walking from the car, like, because I wasn't paying attention to the things she wanted to say. She had to say about something that happened at work or something that was going on. I can't remember because I wasn't paying attention. I was driven. I had to get to that movie because I wasn't going to miss one second of it. Even though it's a 1:10 start time, it's not going to start till 1:20 when you're listening to all. I eat my popcorn before the movie starts. But I still have not yet figured it out to maybe under, you know, and we talk about, you know, walk a mile in her shoes, you know, trying to see the world through her set of glasses. She's an operating room nurse and has been an operating room nurse and a nursing educator for 35 plus years. And it's incredibly stressful. And it's incredibly, in some cases, life or death type situations. And so what she expects of me is to is to clean up my own mess. And if I have a problem, to clean up my own side of the street. And I don't always do that. On Tuesday or Wednesday, it was Wednesday morning. I'd seen Owen at a meeting the night before. He goes, give me a call in the morning. I want to ask you a question or clear something up. So I do. I call him on Wednesday morning. And he goes, now you remember Saturday night, you know, the Al-Anon meeting. And I go, shit. She had invited friends over for dinner. Now, rather than me figuring that out with Owen or myself or seeing if I could work it out, I bother her with it. And that wasn't the right way to handle that problem, because it was my problem, not hers. And I'm so oblivious to that. It's panic, it's anxiety. It's much like I had to figure it out right now. I had to get to the movies right on time. When in fact, you know, I could have worked it out and said, hey, you know, maybe I do get a replacement. And so I don't know. I think I'm better than what I had, where I'd been in the past. And I think our relationship is better. My relationship with my relationship with my daughter has always been, you know, on real good terms. My relationship with my son was only based on the fact that, you know, well, I can't get into trying to explain that so well, but my relationship with my son is better, and my acceptance of some of his behavior, some of his worldview is a lot more tolerant. Because at the end of the day, they're the most important people in my life, other than the fellows and the friends that I've made through the program. Because, like I say, it has changed my life. It's a miracle for a kid or a guy like me that had drank for the better part of 45 years and didn't get stopped drinking till he was 60 and to remain sober for as long as what I have is certainly a gift, and one that I'm very grateful for. I try and dealing with Colleen, I think maybe most important thing is to say, is it the truth? Is it kind and is it necessary? And most of the time when I'm getting myself in hot water, it's because it's not kind or it's not necessary. So I still have a lot of work to do. I send out something to, you know, a few of my fellows in the program every day, whether it's a reading from the 24-hour day book or it's a reading from daily reflections. And it's, in a way, it's my sense of it helps me with kind of like a form of prayer. And sometimes I just send out another little quip or just another little slogan or saying, but I did something different today, and I'll close with this. And I don't know how relevant it may be, but I love music. I love listening to music. I'm a big fan. I always have been since I was a kid. And there was a pretty prominent tenor saxophonist who died today. His name was Pharoah Sanders. And he was born in Little Rock, Arkansas, but raised in San Francisco and played with the likes of John Coltrane. And a song I remember from when I was a kid, I was a 20-year-old kid, there was a song called "The Creator Has a Master Plan." And there was lyrics to it, although it was a jazz piece. And it said, "The Creator has a master plan, peace and happiness for every man." So I'm hoping I can do my part, especially in my own house and in my own family, to be representative of that. Thank you very much for having me.